Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. Today's program came about through a conversation with an author friend of mine, Jerome Peterson. Somehow, the conversation switched from the subject of his books in print and his upcoming book, and we drifted off to the subject of illegal immigrants, and specifically what's happening in Arizona at the moment. It is my great pleasure to welcome Jerome to the program. Jerome, good to talk to you again.
Yes, thank you, Simon. It's good to talk to you, too.
And how is lovely California? Are you...
Well, it's lovely, all right. Right now, it's probably in the low 70s, clear blue sky, sun shining. It's a lovely day out here today, which is nice because we've had...
Carry on.
So it's nice to, you know, have a real spring season, you know.
Ooh. You view that as spring? Here in Mississippi, we're in the hot box. I think it's something like 94 degrees real temperature, and it feels something like 104.
Yeah. So you're like always in the shower. You're kind of always in taking a shower.
We do have our switchboard open, and if any listener has any questions or comments, you're welcome to call in, and the switchboard number is 646-378-1120. Jerome, I know that you're a history fan, and I certainly am a history fan, and the book that you're currently working on in parts talks about the immigration process as it was in the early 1900s and the significance of a place called Ellis Island. What happened back then? How did immigration work at the turn of the 19th century?
Well, first of all, people, there used to be like contracts where companies would send labor agents to recruit laborers in Europe, you know, like steel, coal, and glass companies. And they would send these recruiters over to Europe, and they would post flyers and handbills in these towns advertising jobs, because at that time the economy was fairly poor in most of Eastern Europe, like places like Poland, Germany, Lithuania, and these people would apply to these handbills. It'd be like an employment application. And then if the company was interested in them or hired them, then they would have to make their journey towards the main port, which would be in Hamburg, Germany back then. And say, like my grandpa, he lived in Lithuania. He had to take the journey through Lithuania, Poland, Germany, by train to get to the harbor to board the ship. And then back in those days, these were steamships. And, of course, like anything else, they had to progress, you know, to get better and better. But the initial steamships weren't very, passenger-friendly. Because it kind of depended on how much money you had or have, you know, like all things, even today. Like if you were poor, like my grandpa was, you got a ticket in what they called the steerage class. And that was like below third class. And it got its name, steerage, because the passengers spent most of their time down inside the ship where the steering propeller and all the steering mechanism was. So here you had this little cot, and you were surrounded by all this noise and smell, and you can imagine how hard it must have been to be in that class.
Oh, definitely not fun.
So you really had to be persuaded to leave your homeland and come to a new land, make a new start. You know, you really had to have a solid dream, you know? And I think back then a lot of people had this dream of coming over to America and just making a new life for themselves. They wanted a better life than they had.
The inevitable destination was a place called Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about Ellis Island? What happened?
Well, when the person or persons came over to America, the ship would go into the harbor there, into the harbor, and the first thing they would see would be the Statue of Liberty, which I'm sure would be very stimulating, you know. It'd give you goosebumps. You hear all these stories, you know. If you were an immigrant, you hear all these stories about America and Lady Liberty. Well, that's the first thing you'd see, and then just beyond the Statue of Liberty was this island named after John Ellis, who bought the island a long time ago in the 1700s, and things came to fruition for that, and it eventually became, the stopping point, the main stopping point for immigrants coming from a foreign country. And once you got there, depending on your class, of course, you would go through this process of qualifications. And like I was referring to the steerage class, what happened with them was that they would be carted off on a ferry, and the first and second class people would be let off first. And just like it was more like just a hi, you know, you're welcome. Well, you know, welcome to America, with the first and the second class, because back then there was quite a bit of prejudice as far as a person's income and, you know, their standard in life and their employment. They figured that if a person had enough money to come over here first and second or second class, that they would be a good citizen in the United States. And so they welcomed these people. But as far as people in the steerage class, they were they had to go through medical evaluation. They had to go through their luggage was cleaned, because they just, like I said, back then the prejudice was that if you were poor, you also were ignorant. And so that was the mindset of the employees and the program there at Ellis Island.
Your grandfather obviously did make it through the process.
Yes, he did. Yes, he came over in 1906, and he made it. I don't. That's about all the history I have on him. You know, I don't know all the particulars, but I'm pretty sure he was in the steerage class, and he came over, and he was about 22 when he came over. And he came over by himself. He was all alone.
I think essentially what I'm hearing is that money definitely was a factor. You know, if you had money, it was hello and welcome to your new home. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have money, yeah, it was a bit of a shakedown.
Mm-hmm.
But it's changed significantly over 100 years. Well, no, actually, maybe it hasn't.
because these people, these poor people, they had to go through a fumigation. which is steam, and their luggage went through this. And most of their belongings were destroyed because of the steam. You know, especially if you had something like, like an instrument maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know? Then their belongings were destroyed by all the tests they had to go through medically. It's amazing. You know, people don't realize that back then it was pretty difficult to get into the country. I mean, especially if you were poor. And what they had, too, they would have these spotters. They called them spotters. And these guys would watch the people come off the boat. And if, like, they would label them and make a note. You know, like if the person had a cane, for example, well, they would make a note, this person has a cane. You know, if somebody was a little slow mentally, you know, and they could see that physically, well, they'd make a note. And these guys were good. You know, they could spot somebody with a back ailment or, you know, a bad foot, and they would make a note. And these people had to go through even a more difficult time getting into the country because the United States didn't want, you know, any disabled people into the country. And how would that go across today? That would be pretty... cause a lot of heat, don't you think?
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah.
Look, let's fast forward a few decades. The 60s, 70s, and 80s,
mm-hmm.
the Canadian border was essentially open. There was very, very little effort made by either country to maintain any type of control. In fact, I can remember being in Montana, and the particular border crossing joined two towns, and it was only manned, I think, 10 hours a day. The rest of the time, there was just this simple barrier across the road to prevent vehicles, but you know, any enterprising person could drive around the barrier.
Yeah. But, or just even walk around, too, huh?
Well, exactly. I mean,
yeah.
What I saw was, you know, basically a parking lot either side of the barrier.
No. Yeah.
Right? And, you know, pedestrians could cross at will. But there was a small town on either side. The U.S. folks would walk across for the nightlife and the Canadian beer, and the you know Canadians would you know wander across to the U.S. side because the cigarettes were cheaper and yeah the beer was cheaper. I mean, life was good.
Yeah, life was good if you lived on the border, huh?
Right,
border town. Yeah.
Now, I wasn't in California or Arizona during the 60s and 70s. Was the Mexican border like that during this period?
Well, I was in Phoenix in the mid-70s, 75 to like 78, 79, and from what I can remember, it was like that. You know, I mean, you could just drive across. There wasn't too much security, you know, not many questions or anything, you know. I think back then, too, they were concerned about bringing insects into the country, you know, that would cause crops, diseases in crops, things like that, you know. I think that's about all they did. Because a lot of people would smuggle drugs, you know, marijuana and things, and they were pretty successful.
Right. I remember a road trip. It must have been in the early 80s, and we were coming down the coast,
mm-hmm.
and we hit California, and there was actually a truck stop You know, everyone had to stop. And we were in a motorhome, and the guy could have cared less about drugs or anything like that. He wanted to make sure we didn't have any fruit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I was, yeah, meaning. Because there was some kind of fruit fly, I think, that would get into the fruit, and then that would spread and destroy, you know, that guy's crop or whatever.
Right.
But that's silly. He's more interested in that than he was in illegal weapons or drugs or things like that.
Drugs, booze, things like that, could have cared less about. But he was very insistent. You got any fruit?
Yeah.
it was vaguely reminiscent of something out of Monty Python.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. That's kind of an odd question, though, especially if you got to ask that all day long.
Right. You know,
isn't that kind of silly? I mean, like, one car is not so bad, but, like, 10, 25, 30, 40, 50 cars, you got any fruit?
it was definitely an adventure. You know?
Yeah.
I just went, oh, wow, I'm going to have to remember this one.
Yeah.
I actually like the idea of bringing down the borders, not to initiate any kind of illegal activity, but it just seemed like the way to go. And the 90s started with what I thought was a very significant event, the signing of the NAFTA Treaty. Mm-hmm. While it primarily was dealing with trade, in some ways it also eased the flow of people between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. Is that how you viewed it?
Yeah, because I was living in Phoenix again in the 90s, and it seemed that way. But yet, on the other hand, there just seemed to be an awfully lot of illegals filtering in to Phoenix, mostly for employment. So I'm not sure if that really helped as far as Arizona is concerned. California, I don't know.
9-1-1 changed everything.
Yeah.
I mean, suddenly the walls went up. Do you think that was a positive move?
I do. I do think that was a positive move. Because, nowadays, everything's so high-tech and sneaky, and covert action and things like that. I think that we should be a little bit more on the ball when it comes to our borders. And, all the borders, not just Canada and Mexico, but also the coasts, because there's a lot of immigrants as well coming in from the Orient, Philippines, Chinese, or not Chinese, but Japanese, Filipinos, and Laotians and stuff like that. But, I think the borders should be more secure than they are, yes.
California and Arizona, in fact, Texas, I'll include Texas,
mm-hmm.
do have very large illegal immigrant populations. And I hear two arguments, and I hear them over and over again. All right. Number one is they're stealing jobs from us, from American folks. But most of the jobs are jobs that are very, very low paying. And, the average American would not want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right, because I know that in Phoenix, the Mexican people, they would take the dirty jobs, like landscaping, roofing, jobs that require, you know, you have to be out in the heat, and it's pretty hard to work out in 100 degree heat. But you would see mostly the Hispanic groups working at these jobs and taking any job they can, you know, in that regard. And it's not so much they were stealing the jobs, but they were taking jobs that other people wouldn't take, you know. And I don't think they really were stealing the jobs. I think they just were taking anything they could get so they could save money up for their aunt and uncle to come over to the country, or for them to get legal. And, you know, it seems to me that there's no real black and white answer to this situation. There's a lot of gray area. For example, I knew this one guy that he was Hispanic, and him and his family came over this was in Arizona. Him and his family came over to the U.S., and the way he got into the U.S. is he bought a Social Security number. He got it. It was like on the market, like the black market, and he purchased a Social Security number, knowing that it wasn't his correct Social Security number. You know, it was phony, and he used that because it was the only way he could get over into the United States. And then once he got into the United States, he was making attempts to correct that illegal action. And I don't know how that turned out, or but, you know, he bought a home with that Social Security number. So there's another issue, you know, that people come over here purchasing illegal Social Security numbers. Were you aware of that, Simon?
Yes, and I have a great story.
Oh, great.
In the early 90s, I was working for what was then Security Pacific Bank. They got gobbled up by Bank of America. And we were actually engaged on a very, very large project, consumer loans. I mean, it was kind of seedy. You know, we would be the folks that would put the paper or you know, front the paper for people that wanted to buy a microwave oven or a TV or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. You know, mm-hmm. the sort of things that you find at Best Buy.
Yeah.
We had a team of, 120 programmers, something like that. And we were determining, you know, the best way to handle the accounts,
uh-huh.
and everyone knows that you should never use the Social Security number as a primary key, you know, on a database. I mean, it's, number one, illegal. Well, not uh-huh. not illegal, but, you know, highly discouraged.
Yeah,
but of course,
sure.
Of course, you know, we decided,
yeah,
social
what the heck?
Social's the best unique key there is.
Yeah.
So, you know, we went ahead, and about 6 months after the program launched, and this was across the U.S., we had something like 350 branch offices involved. We discovered a problem that internally we called the wife swapping issue. Oh, no. And it was because, mainly from Mexican illegal immigrants, we discovered that we had something like 400 accounts all using the same Social Security number.
Oh, no so, kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. So, you know, what one person would default on a loan, but, you know, because of our lack of due diligence, we'd send the default letter to someone that hadn't defaulted on their loan. It became quite the issue.
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, man.
Yeah, I remember the wife swapping project quite well.
Are you saying it was fond memories?
No, not
no,
at all.
Okay.
No, it was a lot of 24-hour stints in the office.
Yeah.
Going, oh my goodness. What the hell are we going to do now?
Yeah.
I think the bottom line is Social Security number is pretty much meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's nothing special about the card. There's really nothing much special about the number printed on it.
Huh. Well, can't, you know, hackers or thieves use that number to, like, you know, abuse your credit card or somehow get into your bank account?
Yes. And that's another good reason why it should be a number that is known to you and the government. You know, other agencies, other companies, really do not need it. Well, unless you can think of a good reason.
Yeah. No, I can't.
So there you go, folks. Don't give your Social Security number out, but I'll guarantee that if you try and get a bank loan, open a bank account, buy a car, it's one of the first things they ask you for.
Yeah, that's true. And you know that I remember something else here that I'd like to mention. That you know, maybe the people, our government, needs to consider why are all these illegals coming, leaving their country and coming to the United States? Why not make their country a better place to live? You know, why isn't the Mexican government coming up with programs and stipulations and things, providing jobs and employment for their own people? It's almost like they want their people to leave. You know, they want their poor people to leave and come over to the United States.
Yeah, I've got to kind of side with you on that. I lived in San Diego for a decade, and I worked in an area known as Scripps Ranch. It's rather ritzy. And believe it or not, it's famous for, of all things, eucalyptus trees.
Oh, yeah.
I never saw anyone but foreign workers taking on the dangerous and incredibly low-paying job of trimming them. I never saw an American climb up a eucalyptus. Just didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, I saw the same thing in the huge farming regions.
Uh-huh.
The backbreaking work was all done by low-paid foreign labor.
Right, like the pickers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
that happens a lot out here in the valley, you know, in the San Joaquin Valley. where we California grow has all its orchards and everything. A lot of those people are Mexicans, you know, and some of them just come up for the season and do the picking, and then they return, go back to Mexico. See, and that's a whole nother issue too. Didn't mean to bring that one up.
Oh no, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's easy to go back. It's much harder to come across, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a shameless commercial break. You have two other books in print, Thumb Flagging and The Haunting of Andrew Sharpay.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. Well, Thumb Flagging, it came out last year, and it's basically like a coming-of-age story of a young man who has several problems and admits that he has them, and he even wants help with them. Well, he meets this streetwise friend named Willie, and Willie is a hitchhiking junkie, and he tells his friend, whose name is Jay, he tells Jay that he can cure his confidence crisis if he takes it to the road by way of thumb flagging, which is a term, you know, hitchhiking. And so these two guys go through a series of, meeting people on the road and allowing the rides to help their growth through the experience and the danger and the adventure. And Jay even experiences riding the rails, which really enlighten him quite a bit. And then, of course, I throw in a little romance at the end. It's divided into three parts. And the last part, Jay takes to the road himself, and he really blossoms as a person and a young man, and meets a fellow drifter who's a female, and this changes his whole outlook and his future. And it's a great adventure story. The backdrop is hitchhiking, and if you've ever hitchhiked, I'm sure this will bring back fond memories of...
Oh, I loved the book. I mean, I read it, and I went, oh, this takes me back to the 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something, you know, and I got a lot of... Some of the stories I used... My wife, she hitchhiked quite a bit. In fact, she hitchhiked more than I did. And I took some of her stories and, of course, elaborated them and fictionalized them, and some of my own experience as hitchhiking. And it's a great story, I feel. It's get ready to take to the road if you read it, because you'll want to go somewhere.
Oh, well, I certainly did. I mean, I read it, and were it not that, you know, my wife, you know, would have beaten me with a frying pan, yeah, you know, I was ready to just grab backpack and hit the road.
Come on, Mama. Come on, honey. Let's go. Let's hit the road. What, are you nuts, Simon?
Yeah, I think I do believe it was something like that. She said. And your latest book, The Haunting of Andrew Sharpay, that's a little different.
Yeah, it's completely different. I did a 360 on it. It's basically kind of a mystical thriller type of book, and it's about a young man who goes through a series of bad relationships, and he meets the love of his life, but that love is taken away from him, so he continues wallowing and in alcohol and so on, and he finally meets another woman who just totally changes his whole life and kind of cast like a love spell on him, he thinks. But anyway, she turns out to be a witch, and things just spiral from there, and I don't really want to reveal too much, but it's a pretty good story.
I've gotten pretty good reviews on it. It's a riveting story. I've got to admit that when I finished it, I put it down and I went, this is not Thumb Flagging version 2.
No, it's not.
Where can people find your books?
Okay, I'm on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And, of course, you just type my name in, Jerome Peterson, or the titles. And I'm on Barnes & Noble, and I do have a blog, which is thumbflagging.blogspot.com.
And I will say this. It is well worth visiting. And for some reading entertainment this summer, I can recommend both of the books. In fact, I'm really looking forward to the third book. When is that likely to come out?
Probably the first of next year, most likely. I just have to go through a few more drafts of it, and it should be done. And I'm pretty excited about that story because it's kind of like it's a historical novel that goes through family members, and the family members each have dreams of their own. The brother has a dream of being a farmer, and all he wants to do is farm in America. And his sister, she wants to play music. She's a pianist, and they try to pursue their own dreams, and it revolves around that, and just goes on and on and on. It's a good book. It's coming along pretty good, and it's a historical novel. It's not like Thumb Flagging or The Haunting, which I kind of like to do. Little different, unique stories, rather than the same type.
Right, and I admire you for that. Many authors get jammed into a genre, and that they just stay there.
Yeah, or they get labeled, and they think they have to stay there, or their publishing company says they have to stay there, or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the subject at hand.
Okay.
Arizona has just passed a rather sweeping law that many people are calling racial profiling. What's your view on what's going on over there?
Well, I think that, in today's society, it's kind of like all about me. And people just need to realize that when they go into another country, you have to go through certain things to qualify. Like, I know I have a niece, she lives in Belgium. Well, she had to learn the language before she could even become a citizen. That was like one of the criteria. And there needs to be things like that for all the people that come into this country. There needs to be one main language, and the people need to learn it. And, these people need to be give a certain time so they can get employment and not just, collect all these freebies. And the government needs to stop giving all these freebies. They need to buckle down, and 'cause it's only hurting the people and it's hurting the country. So I'm for this new law.
One of the things that bothers me, it dovetails nicely with something you said, is that if you're going to live here, you need to learn to speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've lived in several countries, and Canada, for example, I think you can take your driver's test in something like 15 different languages. I mean, whoa, hold on. This isn't right. You know, if you're going to live here, you need to be able to speak the local lingo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I live in Mississippi, and I'm busily learning Cajun.
Yeah. Yeah, and all the other slang terms, you know, that people say. Yeah, it's kind of rough, huh? All the different dialects.
But I mean, you know, on a serious note, I mean, uh-huh. How much money do you think is spent each year in, you know, producing documents, government documents, in different languages?
Oh man, yeah. I would say millions of dollars. You know, I just saw something on the internet that the government has been sending checks to dead people, and they've been losing millions of dollars because their system is so off. You know, so I'm sure that with sending documents in multi-languages, it could cost millions of dollars. You know, and I understand, doesn't Canada, of course, there's a lot of French-speaking people there. Is that, that's right, isn't it?
Well, there's this small French enclave, Quebec, but I mean, 90% of Canada is most definitely English-speaking.
Hmm. Yeah. So they probably have documents in French as well as English too, then, huh?
Oh, every government document.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, if you go to your local, Mega Mart and buy a can of baked beans, and you look on the back, on one side it will say instructions, you know, heat and serve. And on the other side, it will say mode d'emploi. That's French for heat and serve, all instructions.
Yeah.
I mean, just in my mind, a huge waste of taxpayers' money, because, you know, it is the taxpayer that foots the bill.
Right.
Did you know that Mexico has actually issued a travel advisory against any of their citizens vacationing in Arizona?
No, I haven't heard that.
Right, because the deal is, if you go there, you're likely to get racial profiled.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I mean, there's other fallout. I'm hearing that companies are pulling out from Arizona,
uh-huh.
because, you know, they face problems down the line that they don't want to deal with. The government of California has actually gone so far as to cancel a number of contracts with Arizona companies.
Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah. I'm seeing an economic impact here. You know, on the one hand, everyone is saying, let's stop the illegal immigration, and on the other hand, they're going, oh God, if we stop it, we're screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a catch-22 syndrome there or something.
Right. In fact, I think it was yesterday or a couple of days ago, I was watching CNN, and they had some government talking head on, and they're threatening to take court action against Arizona.
Oh, yeah. That's what I heard, too. That's a little ridiculous, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
And what I read was that the politicians in Arizona, like J.D. Hayward and John McCain, they support Governor Jan Brewer and what she's doing. So it's not like Republicans against Democrats, because both sides of them agree with what they are trying to do there for the border. So it just seems like our present administration is a little embarrassed that Arizona just picked up the ball and went with it, and they're trying to do something physically and rationally with this problem, trying to solve it.
Okay, but I'm going to go back to something we talked about a little earlier. The rumor mill, the news mill, is that Mexican workers are leaving Arizona. That's got to have a huge impact on the local economy, because as we discussed earlier, who does the fruit picking? Who does the harvesting?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a major effect right there. Yeah, who's going to do it if they leave? I don't know. That's a major problem. And there is a lot of people unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they couldn't go do it. White people couldn't go do it.
But would they?
Yeah, but would they? I don't know. It depends. it depends on your work ethic. If you want to eat or, spend the rest of your time, hand to mouth, getting handouts. I don't know.
Right.
The
one thing I do know is that most people wouldn't settle for less than minimum wage to spend, 8-10 hours a day in the blazing sun picking lettuce.
Right.
Yeah, so what's going to happen? Well, you're going to have to pay the workers more, and that has an effect that's going to hit our pockets. When we go to our local mega mart, suddenly lettuce is going to be $5 a head.
Yeah, it's going to be so ridiculous that you can't afford to buy it.
Right. And I don't much care for lettuce, but that particular part wouldn't bother me. But there is an economic effect on all of this.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, carry on.
I was going to ask you a question. There's one thing, Simon, I'm not quite clear on with these workers. What is their reason for leaving Arizona?
Oh, because they feel that they're now, it's now open season on them. If they, cross the road in the wrong way, if they happen to be sat on a park bench, the cops now have a reason to stop them and demand proof of residency.
Well, okay, but what's wrong with that? In your opinion, is there anything wrong with that? As long as the cops do it in a professional way?
I think that's probably where my problem lies.
Uh-huh.
They've just made it open season.
Yeah.
You see anyone of Mexican origin, you now can stop them and demand these things?
Would it be on the same level like seeing a Muslim on an airliner, on a jetliner, you know, and just having suspicions?
In many ways, it would be.
Yeah.
You know, I've met many Muslims in my time, and none of them are terrorists.
Uh-huh.
You know, most of them are really nice people.
Yeah.
But, you know, suddenly they hit the profile.
Uh-huh.
Is that fair?
No, it's not fair.
Yeah,
that's a gray area.
I mean, here's another issue I have. I lived in Arizona, and I lived in California, San Diego. And, you know, I often view foreign workers not as diluting our culture, but rather enhancing it. I mean, it's an incredibly small thing, but food. I mean, what's the best food you can have? Oh, some real Mexican food.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yeah.
I mean, you don't get that at the, you know, the restaurant chains.
No. Yeah,
you get it at these small mar-and-pop shops that have been there forever. They look like dumps.
yeah, they do. But boy, those people can cook.
Right.
You know, and they just flip them tortillas up and down and roll them up, and mama's in there cooking, and that's great. There was a place that I remember in Phoenix that we used to go to, and it was really small. You know, it couldn't have been much larger than a studio apartment. And you'd go in there, and there'd be like three tables, and, you know, just the food was, what you got for the price was just unbelievable. And you never left hungry. I mean, and you just didn't leave full. You were stuffed when you left, you know. And it was good food, you know. And I agree with you about the culture. You know, there's just not the food, but the music and just the way, you know, families live. Like, I admire the Mexican people for their family values. You know, I mean, they really stick together. They work together, and sometimes they live, like many of them, in such a small house, you know, whereas maybe, you know, other nationalities wouldn't even think of doing that. Do you see that too?
Yes, I do. In fact, one of the companies I worked for in San Diego was a family-owned business, and there was a large Mexican component to the workforce, and once a year there'd be this barbecue, and we'd all head out there, and these people that, you know, you just saw as workers. I won't say grunts, because they weren't. I mean, they were very skilled in what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But they would be cooking, and it was the wife of one of the guys that worked for us that taught me how to make carne asada. It's one of my absolute favorite Mexican dishes. And, you know, she took time to explain the process.
Yeah. Kind of revealing her secret, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow. So do you make it today? Did you pass it on to your wife, or can you make it yourself?
Oh, I can make it. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And I do like to make it.
And you do like to eat it.
Oh, yeah. I certainly like to eat it.
Oh, yeah, sounds good. You're making me hungry, Simon.
same with carnitas. I mean, it's an incredibly simple dish if you do it the right way.
Yeah, really.
Well, one of the problems I see at the moment are the drugs and violence that seem to be flaring up along the Mexican border. I mean, Juarez is about the last town in the world I think I'd want to spend a long weekend in.
Yeah.
I mean, what's going on? How can we fix it?
Well, you know, I think of these tabloids, you know, when you're standing in line at the market and how people complain about how goofy they are and untrue and everything. But, you know, those tabloids would not be in print unless people wanted to buy them. You know, that's what keeps the tabloids going, is people buy those things and read them. So I think we have to, decrease the demand for drugs, so they're not, people don't want to buy them. And as far as the violence, I don't, I think that goes along with our society and a very poor perception towards the quality of life. And I don't know, I think people need to go through some kind of mind change or an enlightenment or something, to get the violence. There's so much violence in the world, and it kind of goes hand in hand with drugs, I guess.
Well, in this particular case, yes,
yeah.
It does. I mean,
yeah.
It's the cartels vying for top spot. The drugs are worth billions of dollars. All you got to do is get it across the border. And I've hosted several programs with people that are very knowledgeable about drugs and violence, ex-mob members, and they don't smuggle stuff across the border. They bribe stuff across the border.
Yeah.
And as long as that continues, I can't see a way to stem the problem.
Yeah, I can't either. And in this part of the country where I live, there's a lot of growers where they have little communities, I guess. Not really communities, I don't know what else to call them, but little spots. Hot spots where they just grow tons of marijuana, and you see busts every now and then. And the majority, and I'm not trying to sound stereotype here, but the majority of the people are Hispanic that run these little lots. And it seems to me that maybe they're growing the drugs here and somehow exporting them to Mexico or wherever, but. And that's where people get a wrong idea, where they see these other nationalities dealing with the drugs, and they think all the Mexican people are like that.
Huh. That's actually an interesting comment. I had a conversation with someone actually from not far away from where you are. And it was on the subject of should marijuana be legalized. And they said, well, absolutely not, because it's going to royally screw our local economy.
Okay.
It was just a small town. Yeah,
yeah.
But... yeah, I mean that's where they make their money is, growing marijuana. And if it's legalized, their ability to market it is going to go downhill.
Yeah.
Jerome,
we're
just about out of time here. I do want to thank you for taking part today, and I want to ask you if you have any parting thoughts for us.
Well, it's been, thank you, Simon, and it's been very enjoyable talking to you again about these subjects, and I hope that what we've mentioned and talked about would help someone else, and, you know, we'll have to do this again, and maybe we'll come up with a solution or something. It's always good to communicate and voice your opinion. But thank you for allowing me to be on your show and for the support that you've given me.
Jerome, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. And I do want to do this again. And next time, I'm going to bring in some of my my other friends.
There
you'll
you go.
Like them.
Is this the gangsters? Mugsy?
Well, yeah, there's always the possibility of a gangster or two turning up.
Mugsy or Bruno, huh?
Something like that. Till next time, have a great day and have fun with your grandchildren.
Okay, thank you, Simon. You have a good day, too.
Okay, I'll talk to you again.
All right. Bye.